This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Daniel Deronda by George Eliot. Chapter 36.
Rien ne pèse tant qu'un secret. Le porter loin est difficile aux dames. Et je sais même sur ce fait bon nombre d'hommes qui sont femmes. La Fontaine.
Meanwhile, Deronda had been fastened and led off by Mr. Vandernoot, who wished for a brisker walk, a cigar, and a little gossip. Since we cannot tell a man his own secrets, the restraint of being in his company often breeds a desire to pair off in conversation with some more ignorant person, and Mr. Vandernoot presently said, "What a washed-out piece of cambric Grandcourt is! But if he is a favorite of yours, I withdraw the remark." "Not the least in the world," said Deronda. "I thought not. One wonders how he came to have a great passion again, and he must have had to marry in this way, though Lush, his old chum, hints that he married this girl out of obstinacy. By George, it was a very accountable obstinacy. A man might make up his mind to marry her without the stimulus of contradiction. But he must have made himself a pretty large drain of money, eh?"
"I know nothing of his affairs."
"What? Not of the other establishment he keeps up?"
"Diplo? Of course. He took that of Sir Hugo, but merely for the year."
"No, no, not Diplo. Gadsmere. Sir Hugo knows, I'll answer for it."
Deronda said nothing. He really began to feel some curiosity, but he foresaw that he should hear what Mr. Vandernoot had to tell, without the condescension of asking.
"Lush would not altogether own to it, of course. He's a confidant and go-between of Grandcourt's, but I have it on the best authority. The fact is, there's another lady with four children at Gadsmere. She has had the upper hand of him these 10 years and more, and by what I can understand has it still. Left her husband for him, and used to travel with him everywhere. Her husband's dead now. I found a fellow who was in the same regiment with him and knew this Mrs. Glasher before she took wing. A fiery, dark-eyed woman, a noted beauty at that time. He thought she was dead. They say she has Grandcourt under her thumb still, and it's a wonder he didn't marry her, for there's a very fine boy, and I understand Grandcourt can do absolutely as he pleases with the estates. Lush told me as much as that."
"What right had he to marry this girl?" said Deronda, with disgust. Mr. Vandernoot, adjusting the end of his cigar, shrugged his shoulders and put out his lips.
"She can know nothing of it," said Deronda emphatically. But that positive statement was immediately followed by an inward query. Could she have known anything of it? "It's rather a piquant picture," said Mr. Vandernoot, "Grandcourt between two fiery women. For depend upon it, this light-haired one has plenty of devil in her. I formed that opinion of her at Lebron. It's a sort of Medea and Creosa business. Fancy the two meeting. Grandcourt is a new kind of Jason. I wonder what sort of a part he'll make of it. It's a dog's part at best. I think I hear Ristori now saying, 'Jason, Jason.' These fine women generally get hold of a stick."
"Grandcourt can bite, I fancy," said Deronda. "He is no stick."
"No, no, I meant Jason. I can't quite make out Grandcourt, but he's a keen fellow enough, uncommonly well built, too. And if he comes into all this property, the estates will bear dividing. This girl, whose friends had come to beggary, I understand, may think herself lucky to get him. I don't want to be hard on a man because he gets involved in an affair of that sort, but he might make himself more agreeable. I was telling him a capital story last night, and he got up and walked away in the middle. I felt inclined to kick him. Do you suppose that is inattention or insolence now?"
"Oh, a mixture. He generally observes the forms, but he doesn't listen much," said Deronda. Then, after a moment's pause, he went on, "I should think there must be some exaggeration or inaccuracy in what you have heard about this lady at Gadsmere."
"Not a bit, depend upon it. It has all lain snug of late years. People have forgotten all about it. But there the nest is, and the birds are in it. And I know Grandcourt goes there. I have good evidence that he goes there. However, that's nobody's business but his own. The affair has sunk below the surface."
"I wonder you could have learned so much about it," said Deronda, rather dryly.
"Oh, there are plenty of people who knew all about it, but such stories get packed away like old letters. They interest me. I like to know the manners of my time. Contemporary gossip, not antediluvian.
These dryest-dust fellows get a reputation by raking up some small scandal about Semiramis or Nitocris. Then we have 1,001 poems written upon it by all the warblers, big and little. But I don't care a straw about the faux pas of the mummies. You do, though. You are one of the historical men, more interested in a lady when she's got a rag face and skeleton toes peeping out. Does that flatter your imagination?"
"Well, if she had any woes in her love, one has the satisfaction of knowing that she's well out of them."
"Ah, you are thinking of the Medea, I see." Deronda then chose to point to some giant oaks worth looking at in their bareness. He also felt an interest in this piece of contemporary gossip, but he was satisfied that Mr. Vandernoodt had no more to tell about it. Since the early days, when he tried to construct the hidden story of his own birth, his mind had perhaps never been so active in weaving probabilities about any private affair as it had now begun to be about Gwendolen's marriage. This unavowed relation of Grandcourt's, could she have gained some knowledge of it, which caused her to shrink from the match, a shrinking finally overcome by the urgence of poverty? He could recall almost every word she had said to him, and in certain of these words he seemed to discern that she was conscious of having done some wrong, inflicted some injury. His own acute experience made him alive to the form of injury which might affect the unavowed children and their mother. Was Mrs. Grandcourt, under all her determined show of satisfaction, gnawed by a treble-headed grief, self-reproach, disappointment, jealousy? He dwelt especially on all the slight signs of self-reproach. He was inclined to judge her tenderly, to excuse, to pity. He thought he had found a key now by which to interpret her more clearly. What magnifying of her misery might not a young creature get into who had wedded her fresh hopes to old secrets? He thought he saw clearly enough now why Sir Hugo had never dropped any hint of this affair to him, and immediately the image of this Mrs. Glasher became painfully associated with his own hidden birth. Gwendolen, knowing of that woman and her children, marrying Grandcourt, and showing herself contented, would have been among the most repulsive of beings to him. But Gwendolen, tasting the bitterness of remorse for having contributed to their injury, was brought very near to his fellow feeling. If it were so, she had got to a common plane of understanding with him on some difficulties of life which a woman is rarely able to judge of with any justice or generosity. For according to precedent, Gwendolen's view of her position might easily have been no other than that her husband's marriage with her was his entrance on the path of virtue, while Mrs. Glasher represented his forsaken sin. And Deronda had naturally some resentment on behalf of the Hagars and Ishmaels. Undeniably, Deronda's growing solicitude about Gwendolen depended chiefly on her peculiar manner toward him, and I suppose neither man nor woman would be the better for an utter insensibility to such appeals. One sign that his interest in her had changed its footing was that he had dismissed any caution against her being a coquette setting snares to involve him in a vulgar flirtation, and determined that he would not again evade any opportunity of talking to her. He had shaken off Mr. Vandernoodt and got into a solitary corner in the twilight, but half an hour was long enough to think of those possibilities in Gwendolen's position and state of mind, and on forming the determination not to avoid her, he remembered that she was likely to be at tea with the other ladies in the drawing-room. The conjecture was true, for Gwendolen, after resolving not to go down again for the next 4 hours, began to feel at the end of one that in shutting herself up she missed all chances of seeing and hearing, and that her visit would only last 2 more days. She adjusted herself, put on her little air of self-possession, and going down made herself resolutely agreeable. Only ladies were assembled, and Lady Pentreath was amusing them with a description of a drawing-room under the Regency, and the figure that was cut by ladies and gentlemen in 1819, the year she was presented, when Deronda entered. "Shall I be acceptable?" he said. "Perhaps I had better go back and look for the others. I suppose they are in the billiard-room."
"No, no, stay where you are," said Lady Pentreath. "They were all getting tired of me. Let us hear what you have to say." "That is rather an embarrassing appeal," said Deronda, drawing up a chair near Lady Mallinger's elbow at the tea-table. "I think I had better take the opportunity of mentioning our songstress," he added, looking at Lady Mallinger, "unless you have done so."
"Oh, the little Jewess!" said Lady Mallinger. "No, I have not mentioned her. It never entered my mind that anyone here wanted singing lessons."
"All ladies know someone else who wants singing lessons," said Deronda. "I have happened to find an exquisite singer." Here he turned to Lady Pentreath. "She is living with some ladies who are friends of mine, the mother and sisters of a man who was my chum at Cambridge. She was on the stage at Vienna, but she wants to leave that life and maintain herself by teaching."
"There are swarms of those people, aren't there?" said the old lady. "Are her lessons to be very cheap or very expensive? Those are the two baits I know of."
"There is another bait for those who hear her," said Deronda. "Her singing is something quite exceptional, I think. She has had such first-rate teaching, or rather first-rate instinct with her teaching, that you might imagine her singing all came by nature."
"Why did she leave the stage, then?" said Lady Pentreath. "I'm too old to believe in first-rate people giving up first-rate chances."
"Her voice was too weak. It is a delicious voice for a room. You who put up with my singing of Schubert would be enchanted with hers," said Deronda, looking at Mrs. Raymond. "And I imagine she would not object to sing at private parties or concerts. Her voice is quite equal to that."
"I am to have her in my drawing-room when we go up to town," said Lady Mallinger. "You shall hear her then. I have not heard her myself yet, but I trust Daniel's recommendation. I mean my girls to have lessons of her."
"Is it a charitable affair?" said Lady Pentreath. "I can't bear charitable music." Lady Mallinger, who was rather helpless in conversation, and felt herself under an engagement not to tell anything of Mirah's story, had an embarrassed smile on her face, and glanced at Deronda.
"It is a charity to those who want to have a good model of feminine singing," said Deronda. "I think everybody who has ears would benefit by a little improvement on the ordinary style. If you heard Miss Lapidoth," here he looked at Gwendolen, "perhaps you would revoke your resolution to give up singing."
"I should rather think my resolution would be confirmed," said Gwendolen. "I don't feel able to follow your advice of enjoying my own middlingness."
"For my part," said Deronda, "people who do anything finely always inspirit me to try. I don't mean that they make me believe I can do it as well, but they make the thing, whatever it may be, seem worthy to be done. I can bear to think my own music not good for much, but the world would be more dismal if I thought music itself not good for much. Excellence encourages one about life generally. It shows the spiritual wealth of the world.
But then if we can't imitate it, it only makes our own life seem tamer," said Gwendolen, in a mood to resent encouragement founded on her own insignificance.
"That depends on the point of view, I think," said Deronda. "We should have a poor life of it if we were reduced for all our pleasure to our own performances. A little private imitation of what is good is a sort of private devotion to it, and most of us ought to practice art only in the light of private study, preparation to understand and enjoy what the few can do for us. I think Miss Lapidoth is one of the few."
"She must be a very happy person, don't you think?" said Gwendolen, with a touch of sarcasm and a turn of her neck toward Mrs. Raymond.
"I don't know," answered the independent lady. "I must hear more of her before I say that."
"It may have been a bitter disappointment to her that her voice failed her for the stage," said Juliet Fenn sympathetically.
"I suppose she's past her best, though," said the deep voice of Lady Pentreath.
"On the contrary, she has not reached it," said Deronda. "She is barely 20."
"And very pretty," interposed Lady Mallinger with an amiable wish to help Deronda. "And she has very good manners. I'm sorry she's a bigoted Jewess. I should not like it for anything else, but it doesn't matter in singing."
"Well, since her voice is too weak for her to scream much, I'll tell Lady Clementina to set her on my 9 granddaughters," said Lady Pentreath, "and I hope she'll convince 8 of them that they have not voice enough to sing anywhere but at church. My notion is that many of our girls nowadays want lessons not to sing."
"I have had my lessons in that," said Gwendolen, looking at Deronda. "You see, Lady Pentreath is on my side."
While she was speaking, Sir Hugo entered with some of the other gentlemen, including Grandcourt, and standing against the group at the low tea-table said,
"What imposition is Deronda putting on you, ladies? slipping in among you by himself. Wanting to pass off an obscurity on us as better than any celebrity, said Lady Pentreath. A pretty singing Jewess who is to astonish these young people. You and I, who heard Catalini in her prime, are not so easily astonished. Sir Hugo listened with his good-humored smile as he took a cup of tea from his wife, and then said, "Well, you know, a liberal is bound to think that there have been singers since Catalini's time. Ah, you are younger than I am. I dare say you are one of the men who ran after Alcarisi, but she married off and left you all in the lurch." "Yes, yes, it is rather too bad when these great singers marry themselves into silence before they have a crack in their voices, and the husband is a public robber. I remember Leroux saying, 'A man might as well take down a fine peal of church bells and carry them off to the steps,'" said Sir Hugo, setting down his cup and turning away, while Deronda, who had moved from his place to make room for others, and felt that he was not in request, sat down a little apart. Presently he became aware that in the general dispersion of the room Gwendolen had extricated herself from the attentions of Mr. Vandernoot, and had walked to the piano, where she stood apparently examining the music which lay on the desk. Will any one be surprised at Deronda's concluding that she wished him to join her? Perhaps she wanted to make amends for the unpleasant tone of resistance with which she had met his recommendation of Mirah, for he had noticed that her first impulse often was to say what she afterward wished to retract. He went to her side and said, "Are you relenting about the music and looking for something to play or sing?" "I am not looking for anything, but I am relenting," said Gwendolen, speaking in a submissive tone. "May I know the reason?" "I should like to hear Miss Lapidoth and have lessons from her, since you admire her so much. That is, of course, when we go to town. I mean lessons in rejoicing at her excellence and my own deficiency," said Gwendolen, turning on him a sweet, open smile. "I shall be really glad for you to see and hear her," said Deronda, returning the smile in kind. "Is she as perfect in everything else as in her music?" "I can't vouch for that exactly. I have not seen enough of her. But I have seen nothing in her that I would wish to be different. She has had an unhappy life. Her troubles began in early childhood, and she has grown up among very painful surroundings. But I think you will say that no advantages could have given her more grace and truer refinement." "I wonder what sort of troubles hers were." "I have not any very precise knowledge, but I know that she was on the brink of drowning herself in despair." "And what hindered her?" said Gwendolen quickly, looking at Deronda. "Some ray or other came which made her feel that she ought to live, that it was good to live," he answered quietly. "She is full of piety, and seems capable of submitting to anything when it takes the form of duty." "Those people are not to be pitied," said Gwendolen impatiently. "I have no sympathy with women who are always doing right. I don't believe in their great sufferings." Her fingers moved quickly among the edges of the music. "It is true," said Deronda, "that the consciousness of having done wrong is something deeper, more bitter. I suppose we faulty creatures can never feel so much for the irreproachable as for those who are bruised in the struggle with their own faults. It is a very ancient story, that of the lost sheep, but it comes up afresh every day." "That is a way of speaking. It is not acted upon. It is not real," said Gwendolen bitterly. "You admire Miss Lapidoth because you think her blameless, perfect, and you know you would despise a woman who had done something you thought very wrong." "That would depend entirely upon her own view of what she had done," said Deronda. "You would be satisfied if she were very wretched, I suppose," said Gwendolen impetuously. "No, not satisfied, full of sorrow for her. It was not a mere way of speaking. I did not mean to say that the finer nature is not more adorable. I mean that those who would be comparatively uninteresting beforehand may become worthier of sympathy when they do something that awakens in them a keen remorse. Lives are enlarged in different ways. I dare say some would never get their eyes opened if it were not for a violent shock from the consequences of their own actions. And when they are suffering in that way, one must care for them more than for the comfortably self-satisfied." Deronda forgot everything but his vision of what Gwendolen's experience had probably been, and urged by compassion, let his eyes and voice express as much interest as they would. Gwendolen had slipped on to the music-stool and looked up at him with pain in her long eyes, like a wounded animal asking for help.
"Are you persuading Mrs. Grandcourt to play to us, Dan?" said Sir Hugo, coming up and putting his hand on Deronda's shoulder with a gentle admonitory pinch.
"I cannot persuade myself," said Gwendolen, rising. Others had followed Sir Hugo's lead, and there was an end of any liability to confidences for that day. But the next was New Year's Eve, and a grand dance, to which the chief tenants were invited, was to be held in the picture gallery above the cloister, the sort of entertainment in which numbers and general movement may create privacy. When Gwendolen was dressed, she longed, in remembrance of Lebrun, to put on the old turquoise necklace for her sole ornament, but she dared not offend her husband by appearing in that shabby way on an occasion when he would demand her utmost splendor. Determined to wear the memorial necklace somehow, she wound it thrice round her wrist and made a bracelet of it, having gone to her room to put it on just before the time of entering the ballroom. It was always a beautiful scene, this dance on New Year's Eve, which had been kept up by the family tradition as nearly in the old fashion as inexorable change would allow. Red carpet was laid down for the occasion. Hothouse plants and evergreens were arranged in bowers at the extremities and in every recess of the gallery, and the old portraits, stretching back through generations, even to the pre-portraying period, made a piquant line of spectators. Some neighboring gentry, major and minor, were invited, and it was certainly an occasion when a prospective master and mistress of Abbots and King's Topping might see their future glory in an agreeable light, as a picturesque provincial supremacy with a rent-roll personified by the most prosperous-looking tenants. Sir Hugo expected Grandcourt to feel flattered by being asked to the Abbey at a time which included this festival in honor of the family estate. But he also hoped that his own hale appearance might impress his successor with the probable length of time that would elapse before the succession came, and with the wisdom of preferring a good actual sum to a minor property that must be waited for. All present, down to the least important farmer's daughter, knew that they were to see young Grandcourt, Sir Hugo's nephew, the presumptive heir and future baronet, now visiting the Abbey with his bride after an absence of many years. Any coolness between uncle and nephew having, it is understood, given way to a friendly warmth. The bride opening the ball with Sir Hugo was necessarily the cynosure of all eyes. And less than a year before, if some magic mirror could have shown Gwendolen her actual position, she would have imagined herself moving in it with a glow of triumphant pleasure, conscious that she held in her hands a life full of favorable chances which her cleverness and spirit would enable her to make the most of. And now she was wondering that she could get so little joy out of the exaltation to which she had been suddenly lifted, away from the distasteful petty empire of her girlhood with its irksome lack of distinction and superfluity of sisters. She would have been glad to be even unreasonably elated, and to forget everything but the flattery of the moment. But she was like one courting sleep, in whom thoughts insist like willful tormentors. Wondering in this way at her own dullness, and all the while longing for an excitement that would deaden importunate aches, she was passing through files of admiring beholders in the country dance with which it was tradition to open the ball, and was being generally regarded by her own sex as an enviable woman. It was remarked that she carried herself with a wonderful air, considering that she had been nobody in particular, and without a farthing to her fortune. If she had been a duke's daughter or one of the royal princesses, she could not have taken the honors of the evening more as a matter of course. Poor Gwendolen! It would by and by become a sort of skill in which she was automatically practiced to hear this last great gambling loss with an air of perfect self-possession. The next couple that passed were also worth looking at. Lady Pentreath had said, "I shall stand up for one dance, but I shall choose my partner, Mr. Deronda. You are the youngest man. I mean to dance with you. Nobody is old enough to make a good pair with me. I must have a contrast." And the contrast certainly set off the old lady to the utmost. She was one of those women who are never handsome till they are old, and she had had the wisdom to embrace the beauty of age as early as possible. What might have seemed harshness in her features when she was young had turned now into a satisfactory strength of form and expression which defied wrinkles and was set off by a crown of white hair. Her well-built figure was well covered with black drapery, her ears and neck comfortably caressed with lace, showing none of those withered spaces which one would think it a pitiable condition of poverty to expose. She glided along gracefully enough, her dark eyes still with a mischievous smile in them as she observed the company. Her partner's young richness of tint against the flattened hues and rougher forms of her aged head had an effect something like that of a fine flower against a lichenous branch. Perhaps the tenants hardly appreciated this pair. Lady Pentreath was nothing more than a straight, active old lady. Mr. Deronda was a familiar figure regarded with friendliness, but if he had been the heir, it would have been regretted that his face was not as unmistakably English as Sir Hugo's. Grandcourt's appearance when he came up with Lady Mallinger was not impeached with foreignness. Still, the satisfaction in it was not complete. It would have been matter of congratulation if one who had the luck to inherit two old family estates had had more hair, a fresher color, and a look of greater animation. But that fine families dwindled off into females, and estates ran together into the single heirship of a mealy complexioned male, was a tendency in things which seemed to be accounted for by a citation of other instances. It was agreed that Mr. Grandcourt could never be taken for anything but what he was, a born gentleman, and that in fact he looked like an heir. Perhaps the person least complacently disposed toward him at that moment was Lady Mallinger, to whom going in procession up this country dance with Grandcourt was a blazonment of herself as the infelicitous wife who had produced nothing but daughters, little better than no children, poor dear things, except for her own fondness and for Sir Hugo's wonderful goodness to them. But such inward discomfort could not prevent the gentle lady from looking fair and stout to admiration, or her full blue eyes from glancing mildly at her neighbors. All the mothers and fathers held it a thousand pities that she had not had a fine boy, or even several, which might have been expected to look at her when she was first married.